Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to open this meeting with a moment of silence or prayer, whatever you want. Followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, I've asked Beanie to read the, Bill to read How It Works for us.
My name is Bill Williams, and I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to constitute what young means. They didn't ask me for my ID when I walked in here, and I see all these young faces. And I've asked a few people, but I can't have any answers. What is the age?
21
years. All right, thank you. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided what we have, what you want, what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnest at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures avail us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us explain what an order can go through with it. I understand what young means now. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like personal adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could restore us, could relieve us our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Okay, and I've asked Beanie to read the 12 traditions for us.
I'm Beanie, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I'm just pleased as punch to be trudging this happy road of destiny with all you folks tonight. I'm glad you decided not to go for the love boat and come for the love machine. So these are the 12 traditions of AA. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. A loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Okay, now for the main event here. This lady here, I understand that she spoke at Fish Lake a while back, and I'd like for you to give a warm welcome to June G. from Los Angeles, California.
Hi, my name's June Guinan, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's really nice to be here, and I'd like to thank all of you for inviting me to come and be part of your conference. I love conferences, and I suppose there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the best reasons is that it gives me an opportunity to see some old friends, and it always gives me a chance to make some new friends. And it's an interesting thing, because I'm the type of person that prior to coming into the program, and even in the first years that I was in the program, I wasn't friendly. By any stretch of the imagination, and I didn't really know what friends were. I didn't believe in the concept, you know. I had grown up in the type of an environment where my philosophy about life was that you had better do it to them before they do it to you, and that's the way I perceived all people that ever passed through my life, and that's exactly the way that I treated them. I was sitting there and I was talking to everybody, and I was feeling pretty nervous. I started to make myself feel better, though, by remembering that when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I refused to listen to any women speakers. I did not believe that any woman anywhere could have anything to say that I would want to hear. Knowing that about myself, I realized that there's got to be a few other tough broads in the room. And not only that, but I'm certain that there's got to be some guys here who don't think that there's a broad in the world anywhere that could tell them anything about anything. And so I know there's not as many people listening to me tonight as it appears. I'd like to welcome those of you who are new or or maybe visiting Alcoholics Anonymous and tell you that I'm not an authority on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the only thing that I'm going to do up here is I'm going to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope, tell you a little bit about how Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in my life. But I'm not an authority, I'm not a counselor on alcoholism, and I have absolutely no real knowledge except for to share with you a little bit of my experience. I also want you to know, if you're new and you don't know very much about Alcoholics Anonymous and the way that this program works, that I'm not paid to get up here and tell my story. And I'm certain when I'm done, you'll think, thank God they didn't have to pay her for that. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a wonderful day today. It started out, I got to go to breakfast with a couple of my old friends. And we sat around and with Mark, I was sitting with Mark and Jack, and we were talking about the conference that they're planning coming up, their ICKIPA conference, and I was fortunate enough to be at the last conference that they were having when they were getting all ready for the ICKIPA, and we were just talking about a variety of things, and I was sharing with them a story of a man that I admire very much in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the people that's passed through my life, and I was sharing with them this story, and maybe I'll tell you a little bit about it. This man was, his name is John B., and he's from Boston, Massachusetts, and when he got sober, he was, I believe, 20 or 21 years old, and he had lived on a reservation, and then been in the Army, and then lived on Skid Row. He had really not done a whole lot of living. He'd just done a lot of what other people told him to do, and then sort of made it on Skid Row, and not really for a very long time before he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he got sober, he was living in the Mission in Skid Row in Boston, and he had wine sores all over his body, and his sponsor, the man who became his sponsor, took him to meetings every night and would pick him up. And John was very proud, and he didn't like to accept things from other people. It was just part of the person that he was. And this man that picked him up every night would come and bring a sandwich, a whole sandwich every night. And he'd say, gee, you know, my wife always makes me this sandwich, but I can only eat half of it. Would you mind helping me out? Because I don't like to hurt her feelings and take it back uneaten. Would you mind sharing it with me? And I was just sharing that story with them, and I was thinking of how often that has been, how Alcoholics Anonymous has worked in my life. People that have passed through my life knowing something a little bit about me and about the type of person that I am and where I came from and knowing how best to deal with me. Not too long after that, I ran into a guy that's from my hometown, or at least we got sober in the same hometown. Dennis and I got sober down in Venice. And Dennis from Venice, isn't that cute? And we were standing around, we were talking about the way things were, and he introduced his wife to me as Crazy June, and I hadn't heard that one. But it was neat, you know, we just sat there talking, and then we went to a meeting, all of us, and when we were sitting in the meeting, Dennis was sharing about how he had gotten into the program and where he had come from, how he had come out just out of the penitentiary when he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had many of the same attitudes that I had about people and the world and everyone in it. But what I was listening to him share was he was talking about how it was just this year, you know, having turned 12 years sober was one of the first times that he experienced having his feelings hurt, and that's exactly the type of person that I have been in my sobriety, in that I have always tried to control and avoid my feelings. I've always tried to not recognize that soft person or the vulnerable person inside of me. And I don't suppose for me to just stand up and tell you a little bit about that's going to make much sense unless I tell you a little bit about where I came from. I grew up in Venice, and for those of you who don't know, it's a beach town in Los Angeles. And when I grew up down there, I was raised by an alcoholic mother, and so I learned a lot about alcoholism firsthand. And there were a lot of other things that I learned very quickly. It seemed to me as I watched men and women in my life, most of them being alcoholic, but as I watched them, I noticed that the same people, these men and women, handled exactly the same situations in entirely different ways. And in fact, to the best of my recollection, I did not recall ever seeing a man cry until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took that to mean that men don't cry, that men don't get hurt, that men don't feel things, with the exception of anger and rage. And the only thing that I thought that you could do is perhaps if a guy got upset enough with you and cared about you a little bit, maybe you could make him punch you in the face. But outside of that, I really didn't believe that you could get any kind of an emotional reaction from a man. On the other hand, although a lot of the women in my life, including my mother, acted with a lot of violence and rage, I knew that they felt pain. I saw them cry, and I saw things hurt them. And I looked at those two different groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And when I was a little kid, and they said, well, June, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, a boy. And they told me that I couldn't, because it wasn't as easy back then as it is now. But that's what I wanted to be. And when I finally accepted that I couldn't be a boy, I had to settle for the next best thing. And the way that I saw the world, that was to be a tough broad. and I spent all my time before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. I don't know, I suppose a tough broad varies depending on what area you're living in and what everyone else around you is doing. What I did was I ran with the gang and I did a lot of fighting. I want you all to know that I've never won a fight yet. On the other hand, I have never fought a group of less than five at a time. And I learned after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that there was a reason why I always set things up that way. I always fought groups of from 5 to 15 because that way if I lost, everybody'd think, well, you know, how could she possibly have won and she must have been pretty tough or why would that many people have jumped her? And it was one of those type of things where I was willing to walk around with my face bashed in a lot so that other people could think that I must be pretty tough, and that's exactly what I did. One of the other things that I used to do was down in Venice, nobody wore shoes if you were a tough broad. And we would stand down there on the boardwalk and tourists or a variety of people would walk by and I would take my cigarette and I would throw it down and I would put it out with my bare feet. And people would poke their friends and then they'd whisper to one another and of course I knew what they were saying. It was very clear to me. They were saying, wow, that's one tough broad, isn't it? And it wasn't until after I'd been sober for a while that my sponsor convinced me that perhaps what some of those people were saying was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything that stupid? And of course, merely putting the cigarette out with my bare foot was not enough. What was really the challenge in being a tough broad was whether you could walk on those feet as if they didn't hurt. And so those were the kind of things that I spent a lot of my time doing before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had an obsession before I was introduced to alcohol or any other chemicals, some of which I used. And what that obsession for me was suicide. And it began at the age of 5 years old. And from that time, at the age of five, I began to take overdoses of baby aspirin. I began to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades and do any number of things to harm myself in a physical way. The fact is really is that I can't give you any psychological or whatever definition of why I did that or you know what made me do that. I've been to psychiatrists before coming to the program, but I never told them anything because I always felt they should work for their money. So I can't give you any diagnosis. But in coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and in looking back on the person that I was and the way that I saw life, I've come up with an explanation that seems to work and be comfortable for me. That being that, as I've already told you, when I looked at men and women in these two different groups of people to determine which one I wanted to be like, the reason that I wanted to be like a man was because I didn't want to care about anyone. I didn't want to feel anything. I didn't want anyone ever to make me cry or make me feel anything at all. What I really wanted was I wanted the ability to walk into a room and I wanted people to back away in terror. Now, when you're 87 pounds, that rarely happens. But that is exactly what I wanted, you know. And when I started to go to school at about the age of 5 years old, all these kids would tease me, probably in much the same way that they tease every other kid that was there. But I remember what was said. I could probably even tell you the names of the kids that said it to me. And I remember when they teased me about being skinny and having curly red hair and all those things and what my mother was a drunk and all of that. I remember how much it hurt me inside. I remember it felt like I was being cut up with a knife. And I remember wanting to cry. And I think even on some occasions I did actually cry. And for me, the idea of crying or of letting anyone make you feel anything can only be defined as one thing. It's weakness. And so at the age of 5 years old, I discovered that I was the thing that I hated the most in the entire world. I was a weak person. I could not control my emotions. Other people were perfectly able to hurt me. I seemed to have absolutely no insulation. And at that time, I began for me to hate myself. And so often when people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about their drinking and their possible use of other things while they were out there, how they lost their self-worth and they lost their self-respect, I got to tell you, I don't really identify with that. Because for me, I never knew what self-worth was or self-respect until long after I'd been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only feelings that I ever remember having for myself were self-hatred. I have never liked the way that I looked. I have never liked where I was living. I have never liked anything that was going on in my life. And most of all, there was never an instant until long after I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I liked the way that I was feeling. It always hurt too much. Fortunately for me, I was introduced to drugs at the age of 7 years old, and when I was 8, I began to drink on a regular basis. When I was 9, I found the combination that I was to use, and what that was alcohol and barbiturates, or reds, or yellows, or sleeping pills, whatever you might know them as. And I'm not telling you any of that because I want to impress you with what a cool dope fiend I was. I really wasn't, you know. I only used those chemicals because the combined effect of those chemicals got me where I wanted to go. And I wasn't a party girl. I don't have any exciting stories to tell you about my drinking or my using or any of that. Because what I used to drink and use for was because I wanted to be in a state of absolute oblivion. I wasn't interested in feeling good. I wanted to feel absolutely nothing at all. And I used those pills as often as I could to try and kill myself and was never very successful in doing it. But that was the way that I survived out there until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel very fortunate that I was introduced to drugs and alcohol when I was 7 years old, because I honestly believe that had I not been, I would have had to be locked up in some kind of an institution, because it was just too much for me out there. And once I found alcohol, I was able to not feel anything anymore. I was able to not care anymore. And that was the only way that I was able to sort of skate by out there for as long as I did. I never went through a day before I came into this program that I didn't try to kill myself, put myself in a situation where someone else would kill me, or pray to a God that I was quickly losing faith in to take my life. And that's just sort of the way that it was for me. And I know that's not the way it was for many people, but I just don't know very much about social drinking. And the reason I can't tell you anything about any kind of exciting stories is because when you're taking those kind of pills and drinking alcohol with them, you can't do much. And I didn't. I spent a lot of time laying around and throwing up. And that's basically my story until I came into the program. I didn't drink or use chemicals for a long period of time compared to most of the people that I have since met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet by the time I got here, I had absolutely no place left to go. Actually, you know, when I was thinking about this tonight, I was thinking about the way that I got here and how lucky I was that I got here when I did. When I was maybe 5 or 6 years sober, something like that, I noticed that a lot of my women friends that were in the program were getting tattoos. And some of the women that were coming in were getting tattoos. And most of them were getting little tattoos like flowers and butterflies and bunny rabbits, you know, and some beautiful little works of art. And I thought they were just darling. But I'm very glad tattoos were not popular when I was on the streets, because I would be standing up here tonight and I would have a shark on my arm. And it would swim whenever I did this. And then I would have had something, you know, like a battleship on my chest, or maybe a canoe in my case. But if I had... That wasn't that funny. But if I had thought that it was something that was tough, and that maybe someone, just anyone, whether I knew him or not, would think that it was tough, I would have done it. Anyway, I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was brought here by my mother, who had been in and out of the program for, I think, about 12 years at that time. And she brought me to a meeting, not because I'd asked for help, certainly not because I wanted to go. She just forced me into the meeting. And the miracle of the program began for me that night as I walked through the doors of that meeting. Because there was a guy there in that meeting that I admired more than anyone else in the world. And I admired him for a lot of reasons, some of which maybe a lot of you are not going to identify with, but I know that Dennis at least will. And when I saw this guy, I looked at him and I just thought about all the reasons I admired him. You know, he'd been in prison, he had tattoos, he carried a knife and had it with him that night, he rode a motorcycle, he was extremely violent, and everyone in my neighborhood was afraid of him. And I looked at this guy and I thought, wow, I just never thought people that great came to AA. You know? This man was everything I had ever wanted to be. He was the type of person that when he walked into a room, people backed away from him in terror. And he was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when the miracle of the program happened for me, even though I didn't get sober that night. I got drunk the next night. And then I came back to some meetings. And during a two-week period of time, I went to lots of meetings, because this guy Paul was going to lots of meetings. And so I sort of followed him all over the place. And we talked a lot. We talked a lot about the program. We talked a lot about my life. Spent a lot of the time trying to convince Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, that I was far too young to be an alcoholic, that I hadn't gone nearly as far as my mother and real alcoholics like that. And I later learned that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince other people that they're not alcoholic. They already know that, you know. But finally, Paul turned to me and he said, you know what, June? He said, I'm going to tell you something. They've told me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I cannot diagnose anybody's disease but my own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I've seen the way that you drink and I've seen the way that you use drugs. And he says, in my opinion, if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't making up some terror, you know, tale to tell me, like somebody maybe in high school would, who had read some book somewhere. He was just stating facts. He was talking about things that had happened to him. He was talking about some things that had begun to happen to me. And I just thought a little bit about what he said. But I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to come into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that my mother had been in this program and was in this program at that time. And I blamed my mother. I'm outside of myself and the hatred that I felt for myself. There wasn't anyone in the world that I hated more than my mother. Mainly because I perceived her alcoholism and all the resulting effects of that as weakness. And as I've already told you, weakness is something that I refuse to tolerate in anyone that was near me. But I sort of thought about hanging around these meetings, but I didn't want to. And then, as I was saying, absolutely every alternative but Alcoholics Anonymous was removed from my life. At that time, as I lived with my mother, I was unable to control the hatred that I felt for her, and I would attack her. And she did not think that in sobriety she had to be subjected to that any longer, and she asked me to leave her home, and I did. I hadn't been allowed in my family's home or to call any of the other members of my family for about 3 years at that time, and I certainly wasn't welcome to do it then, and I did not call them. I had been in about 6 foster homes up to that point. I'd been thrown out of all of them, and none of them would consider taking me back. I tried to get to some of the drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes that we had in Los Angeles at that time, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some because of my attitude. And then I thought, well, you know what? Who needs all those programs and all those people and that family? Because I got my gang. And then one day as I walked down an alley, the 5 members of my own gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 87 pounds, and I had a black eye, and I had a swollen lip, and I had no place to live, and I had no family, and I had no money, and I had no shoes. Of course, at that time, I wouldn't have worn them if I'd had them because I was a tough broad from Venice. And I had absolutely nothing. And so I decided to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it really wasn't, you know, one of those kind of things with, would you like to go to Hawaii or join AA? It really was very simply AA. Now, as I began to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were a few people at that time who were not aware of the tradition. And the reason I say that is because some of them would come up to me after meetings and they would tell me that I was too young to be an alcoholic and that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic, and they didn't want little kids sitting in their meeting while they were talking about serious things. And I thought, hey, these people must have really gone far, you know. And I just thought, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't want me either. And that didn't surprise me. As I've already told you, nobody else wanted me at that point, and I didn't want me either. And so I fell back on the number one answer that I'd been using since I was 5 years old. I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I ever went at anybody's house I visited. I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took an overdose. And before I passed out, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know about here in Utah, but in West Los Angeles, where I got sober, they very rarely call on people to participate who are laying in the meeting. But by the time I got to the meeting, I was unable to stand or sit up, and I had to lay down. And they asked me to share, and I certainly can't tell you what I said, but the next thing that I recall was coming to in a hospital and being given medication to make me throw up, and a doctor explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart, and had I gotten there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I can't tell you exactly why that was any different than any of the other overdoses that I'd inflicted upon myself, but I know that it was, because since that time, I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up. And if I continue to do that, the 13th of July of this year, I'll celebrate 13 continuous years of sobriety. I know that that day, as I sat in that meeting, no matter what came out, no matter how jumbled, no matter, you know, how incoherent I actually was, I think what I was trying to say to those people in that meeting is, you know what? I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone a little bit farther than some of you. But I don't really think that's the point here. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. All I know is I just can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me if I go back out there on the streets, I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Dying is what I've been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live this way for another 20 or 30 years like some of you people have. And that's what I can't stand. I can't stand living this way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And in staying, I've had to do the things that have been necessary for me to stay. And in some ways, they're very much the same for all of us. And in other ways, they're different. I learned very early in my sobriety about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. In particular, the third tradition, which is the one that states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. I think that's one of the greatest things that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you ever get an opportunity and you're looking and you're 12 and 12 and you got a spare minute, you ought to take some time to read what was going on when they were deciding to use that third tradition in the program. Because they've got a lot of requirements for membership that they were originally going to have. They weren't going to allow anybody who had been in any insane asylums. They weren't going to allow anybody who'd been in prison. They certainly didn't want any fallen women. And I don't know about any of you, but that would have excluded both my sponsors and most of my closest friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, including me, if they'd added those requirements. So I'm real glad that they decided to just keep it simple and say that the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. But that doesn't mean that there weren't still people who thought that I was too young. There were still people who'd come up to me after meetings and they'd say, you know, kid, I spill more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And I turned to them and I explained to them that perhaps if they hadn't spilt so much, they would have gotten to AA younger. Leanne, can I steal your water? Or Ernesto's, whoever's it is? Thanks. I'm extremely grateful, and more so the longer that I am sober, for those people who tolerated me when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I choose the word tolerate rather than love because it's far more appropriate in my case. When I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I continued to wear my motorcycle jacket, which said on the back of it, "Do unto others," and then split. I wore motorcycle chains around my wrists, and I started to smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day. Now, there isn't anyone who ever lit any of those cigarettes. I always lit my own cigarettes. If anybody wanted to hold a match, I allowed them to hold it as long as they would like. But they never touched my cigarette with it. There were a lot of people, you know, we'd be walking into a meeting or a coffee shop and somebody'd hold a door and I'd allow them to hold it as long as they would like. When they would get tired and the door would close, I would open it for myself and I would walk through it. I didn't accept rides or ask for rides in meetings. I either walked or I hitchhiked. I didn't want anyone anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous to think for one instant that I needed you or anything or anybody. And of course, that's really rather funny because if I'd been doing all that well by myself, I wouldn't have had to come here at all, you know. But it was very important for me that you thought that I didn't need any of you. After I'd been around for a couple of weeks, I took up smoking cigars and a pipe because I found that there seemed to be a lot of people around me that were very offended by that. And so I did it so I could keep people away. I was absolutely, I don't know, Dennis was talking about the rage, you know, that he had was experiencing when he came to the program. And that is true for me also. I had never stopped at anger. I had always just gone straight over to rage. It was one of the only emotions I allowed myself to feel, and so I did a lot of time feeling it. But I wanted no contact with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want anybody to hug me, I didn't want anybody to kiss me, and they did not. I also came to this program with an extremely limited vocabulary. It consisted almost solely of profanity, with the exception of a few other words like the and mother. And that was it, you know. And I found that there were certain people who were very offended by that language, and so I made it a point to use it when they were around. And again, that was because I really just wanted to be left alone. And I'd like to let you know that by choosing to act in that manner, there were times where I could sit in a meeting and have an entire row all to myself. Between the cigar smoke and my language, there were a lot of people who didn't want to sit next to me. But I was lucky enough to find 2 sponsors when I came to the program. 2 people that, well, one actually, because he had come from a similar background as I had, and he seemed to understand exactly what I was doing. And the woman who became my sponsor simply because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, which in her program dictated that if someone asked her to be her sponsor, she accepted. But these 2 people became my sponsors, and Jeff and I would go to meetings, and when Jeff thought that I was getting out of hand, either being too vulgar or smoking too many cigars, whatever it might be, he would grab me around the neck and he would threaten to kill me. Now, you're not going to find that anywhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially in the chapter Working with Others. But it was something that always managed to get my attention. And then I could listen to Jeff for a few minutes and just be quiet. And the other person that became my sponsor was a woman named Gail Wilson. And that's really a rather strange story in itself because, first of all, she was a woman. Now, as I've already told you, I refused to listen to women speakers. I did not like women. I was a tough broad, and I wasn't even happy about that. I wanted to be a guy, but I had to settle for that, and I didn't like women. And Gail was really, she was, you know, of the woman variety. She was completely different than I was. Not only did she not use the same language I used, she didn't know what most of the words I was using meant. And we would go to meetings, and actually, the way that she first became my sponsor was I went to 21 meetings a week for most of my first year of sobriety. And it seemed to me as I went to all these meetings that Gail Wilson talked at about 18 of those meetings every week. And so I thought to myself, perhaps if I ask her to be my sponsor, I won't have to hear her so often. I can find out where she's talking and not go there. And that's why I asked her to be my sponsor. Anyway, she was, as I said, she was very different. She was from the South, and she had a mother and a father, which I tried not to hold it against her. I knew it wasn't really her fault. But I did. And I would go to meetings, and she would come up to me, and she'd say, "Do not sit next to me at the meeting. I can't take the cigar smoke. And not only that, please don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And that was fine with me, because really, I didn't want anyone to know that I was hanging out with her either. You know, it was bad for my image as a tough broad to hang out with this lady from Kentucky. And so we would meet secretly after meetings and discuss the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember I was made the greeter at one of the meetings that I regularly attended, and I had to stand there and welcome the newcomers and everybody else as they came through the door, and I would stand there with my motorcycle jacket and cigars, welcoming the newcomers as they came in. Once in a while, I'd hear one of their sponsors whisper to them, "You see, if you keep drinking, you'll end up like that." I used to stand there, and somebody would walk in and say, "Hi, I'm Kathy," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm June," and somebody else would walk up and say, "Hi, I'm Linda," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Kathy," because all I could remember was the last thing I'd heard, you know. I used to try and have conversations with people, and they'd be talking to me, and I'd be talking, and all of a sudden, I'd just stop. I'd go, "Bird!" And then I'd come back. And that was just the way that my mind was sort of functioning. Physically, I wasn't in nearly as bad a shape as a lot of people that come into the program, but mentally, I was really being competitive up there. I heard music for the first 6 months that I was sober, and that was when the radio was not on. And I never told anyone in the program because I was afraid that they would have me locked up. And I remember I saw this woman get a 9-month chip, and she got up and she said, "And I heard music for the first 6 months that I was sober," and I thought, "God, I should have talked to her. We'd probably been listening to the same station, you know." When I got sober at the Monday Night Venice group, they used to stand up and they'd say, "The most important thing that you can do if you're new is get that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you got that book, then you're all set because you're going to find out about what this program's about. But if you don't have the book and you don't have money to get that book, that's the way most of us got here. Don't worry about it. You can take the book for nothing down and nothing a week until you get on your feet." And then they'd throw in at my group, "And if you're too afraid to talk to us about it, or you don't want to talk to us about it, just steal it." Now, where I had come from, stealing was a way of life, you know. And I didn't see that I should have to give up stealing because I was quitting drinking. They're entirely different things. And I had no intention of quitting stealing, and I didn't. After I got in the program and I heard that at the meeting, I thought, "Well, you know what, though? If I steal that big book from an AA meeting, it'll probably jinx my sobriety." And I was worried about that. So I instead went down to the local library in Los Angeles, and I went in there and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. While I was there, I picked up a copy of the 12 and 12 because I didn't see any reason to make two trips. And I didn't feel bad about that. I thought the library has lots of books, you know. And I knew I couldn't afford the book, so I ought to steal it. That was my philosophy about life. And I remember that night I called Jeff up, my sponsor, and I said, "Hi, Jeff, stole the big book today." And I remember he didn't say, "You know, June, we don't steal anymore now that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous." I remember he said, "That's great, kid, you got the book." Because he knew with someone like me, that's where I had to start. First, I had to get the book. And somewhere along in my sobriety, I realized that I was no longer comfortable with stealing. I don't know where that happened. You know, I don't know a specific thing that occurred in my life where that changed. But I realized suddenly that I didn't have the right to take everything that I wanted just because I didn't have it and somebody else did. And I wasn't comfortable with that any longer. And so I loaded up all these books that I'd stolen from the library over the years. And I had 20 or 30 great classics like Misty the Seahorse, the kind of things you steal when you're 6 years old. And I loaded them down up and took them down to the local librarian, and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it was necessary for my sobriety to return those books. And I asked her if it was all right if I made payments because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books for 11 years. She said, "Oh, that'll be fine." She said, "You know, it's funny, though. She said, I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach. This man came in, and he had this book for 37 years. He said the same thing you just said. She says, you guys must do this all the time." I found out that that's true. I'll talk a little bit about, you know, when I got to the program, I was single. And if you come into the program single, I have some bad news for you. At least it was bad news for me. You're probably going to have to learn how to date. And I'm really sorry about that. I just can't see any way around it. I think it would have been much easier to drink and date and get married and then live happily ever after rather than doing the dating part sober. But anyway, for those of us who've gotten sober and are single, I guess we don't have that option any longer. But I remember when I got sober, I hated all people who were married. I mean, I hated large groups of people anyway. I hated all people who owned cars because we'd never owned a car. I hated all people who were married because no one in my family had ever been married, and I knew that once you got married, you lived happily ever after, and so I didn't like those people. And I hated other large groups of people. I wasn't really a prejudiced person because I basically hated everyone. But anyway, I hung around the meetings, and eventually if you come in and you're single and you're sober, you're going to have to go out on an AA date. Now, I don't honestly know if you have these here in Utah. In Los Angeles, though, we have them, and what that is a guy will ask you out, and then he'll take you to a meeting. I mean, where else would you go? You know. And then after the meeting, you'll go to coffee, and you'll talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. Those are the kind of things that we had in L.A. Anyway, I remember one of my dates, I was at the coffee stage of the date, and the guy said to me, he said, "You know, I really like you." And I said, "Well, thank you." He said, "But I like your girlfriend over at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her?" And I said, "No," and he did. And then I went home and I thought things through. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but for me, one of the worst things that I can do is go home alone and think through my problems. Because invariably, I come up with a solution. And my sponsors have convinced me over the years that I have never yet had a problem that has been as bad as my solution for it. That next morning I got up and I had arrived at a solution, and I went down that day and I tried to join the United States Air Force. Just thought, forget it, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me, and so then I called my sponsor. Now that's what I'd suggest to you. If the Air Force won't take you, then you should try calling your sponsor. And I explained to my sponsor that it just wasn't fair, that everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous had a relationship but me, that I went to meetings and it looked like Noah's Ark. Everybody was arriving in pairs, you know, and I just didn't understand it. And he told me, he said, "Listen, June," he says, "I'm going to tell you something. Someday you're going to meet Prince Charming. He may even be on a white horse. The problem is, before you meet Prince Charming, you have to kiss a lot of toads." And I put that sign up on my wall. And it was something that helped me get through the next couple years. Because when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely no sense of humor. Nothing was funny, particularly if it related to me and my life. My life was very sad. And I did not appreciate anyone attempting any humor at my life. I mean, my life was Kleenex time, okay? And my sponsors, they were really cruel people. I don't know if you guys have cruel sponsors here, you know. But like, for example, you call them up and you tell them your problems. All your problems. And what do they say? Go to a meeting. Now, that's not an answer. You know, that's like asking somebody, "What time is it?" And they say, "It's a horse." You know, that doesn't help. And so invariably, you explain it to your sponsor again, slower. You know, maybe they've had a hard day. And then they say, "Go to a meeting and read the book." And it's like you're talking two different languages half the time. But you just go to the meeting and read the book just to show them that they're wrong. And then you don't tell them when you start to feel better, because you don't want them to know they were right. But